Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there, and while you're over there, check out the events page. You can find out about all the events that we're having in 2021, which, Chad, when this releases, it'll be 2021.
Yeah, I'm ready.
You're ready? I'm ready. I've heard, Chad, that everything's going to magically change. The calendar flips, and the dumpster fire that is 2020 just magically goes away.
Oh, man, there's nothing like the turning of the clock hands to solve all our problems.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in fact, it's actually impossible for 2021 to be worse than 20. It's not possible.
Let's just call it a jubilee year.
Yes.
All debts all debts forgiven, all jobs restored, all health back. Yeah.
I feel like there's going to be a bunch of people that wake up on January 1st, they wake up and they say, "You mean this coronavirus is still a thing? What? I thought 2021 was the vaccine. I thought that was it."
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, would that it were so.
Yeah, it would be nice. But don't worry, guys, because there's one thing that 2021 does have, and that's a regional event in April in Bentonville, Arkansas that you can come to. So that's something different. So we'd love to have you come hang out with us in April 16th and 17th. Chad will be there. I'll be there. A whole bunch of other people will be there. It's going to be a great two-day event. We'd love to see you. And then, of course, the national event in October. You go to the events page. You can get all the information about that stuff. All right, man. We are in 1 Samuel 22.
Yeah, we're going to start out here with description of David's next place of refuge and the kind of interesting group of people that hang out around him. Last time we wrapped up with the humorous story of David pretending to be a madman and by means of that escaping from the king of one of the Philistine cities. So he gets away from there and he's got to go someplace because he certainly cannot return to his hometown, cannot return to Saul. So where is he going to go? Well, it says that verse 1 of 1 Samuel 22 says that David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's household heard of it, they went down there to him. So this cave is going to come up a couple more times. In fact, in First Chronicles, it's referred to simply as the Rock. So I'm assuming this geographical feature just kind of became known as David's place, the Rock, the Cave of Adullam, David's hideout, probably known by several different names. And caves are mentioned all over the Old Testament. I remember when I was writing Unveiling Mercy, and I talked about, I can't remember the text where the word cave came up that I cited on that particular day, but I remember just doing a word search and I was astonished by how many references there are to caves in the Old Testament, just like one after the other. And they're used for all sorts of things. The first occurrences, if I remember correctly, back in Genesis are caves as a burial place, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's where patriarchs, matriarchs were buried,
you buy yourself a cave, right?
Yeah. Get yourself a cave, make it into a burial plot for you and your family. Keep everybody together. And then caves came up, of course, in books like 1 Samuel as a hideout, more or less. Yeah, which makes pretty good sense. It's a natural stronghold. If you only got one way in and one way out, there are weaknesses to that because you can get trapped in
like
there.
Like setting a fire right in the front of it. And
yeah. Yeah, not good. And then also interestingly, in Jeremiah, which is quoted by Jesus, when Jeremiah refers to how the religious authorities of his day had turned the temple into a den of robbers, the Hebrew word there is actually cave. So it kind of makes sense. You know, if you watched old Westerns like I used to growing up, a lot of times the bad guys will hang out in a cave. So turns it into a den of robbers. And of course, that's what Jesus quotes on the day that he overturns the tables of the money changers and purges the temple. But anyway,
caves are interesting, man. I used to do quite a bit of caving or spelunking, as it's called.
Oh, you did?
I did.
I didn't know that about you.
I did used to do a lot of that. So the Ozarks have a lot of caves. And So, yeah, I used to do that a lot. I've spent 20 hours inside of a massive cave system one time with two other guys.
Oh, wow.
20 hours, slept in there. Like, it was, I was thinking, we didn't even get to the end of it. I mean, it was just this massive cave system we were in. That, which is a little bit creepy when you're in a cave, when you're in a cave that long and you're like, there is only one way out of here.
But yeah, so how do you find your way back out once you've gone in there quite a while?
You can throw markers at turns. You know, it's spray paint or something in there, but you can throw like a glow marker and that kind of stuff, so you know. Well, what's interesting is if you go into especially big caves, if you go into big caves, you will find, if it's not a cave that a lot of people have been in, you find all kinds of weird stuff in there. It's very obvious that, like, a long time ago, people were in that cave, and they left stuff in there. There was a cave I was in where we found, like, a massive stockpile of arrowheads in this cave. Which made you think, like, okay, like, Osage Indians or whatever are holed up in this thing making arrowheads.
Preparing either for a hunt or for a battle. One of the two.
Yeah. So we're not that far removed, I guess is what I'm saying, from caves serving that same kind of purpose.
Yeah. I suppose the most famous caves in Israel would be the ones where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, mm-hmm. of course, you know. And you know, those caves had, of course, always been there. No one had just taken the time, at least in a long time, to explore them. And then, lo and behold, they find these jars that have some of the scrolls inside them. So caves were used, obviously, as kind of a storage place, or at least to hide materials and to hide men, to bury bodies, just kind of a natural place for things like that to happen in.
Yeah, so, if you know some, like, nasty weather's rolling in, I mean, a cave's a good place to be before yet. I mean, if you didn't have houses or cars or anything like that, a cave is better than a teepee in tornado season.
Yeah, this is true. So David made a good choice. He went to this cave. This one's a cave of Adullam, which is located on the kind of the western side of the territory of Judah. And he's not there alone. At this point, as far as we know, he has been alone. Remember, he showed up to get some bread from the priest and a weapon. He's got Goliath's sword. Then he goes down to the city of Gath, the Philistine city of Gath, and presumably he's alone there. And now, when he gets to the cave, it says his brothers and all his father's household heard about it, and so they went down there to him. Now, I think the last time we heard about his brothers was when he showed up for the battle with Goliath, and things did not go so smoothly with his brothers back then, especially his oldest brother, who basically told him, you know, what are you doing here? You should be with the sheep. And they exchanged some brotherly words there before the battle with Goliath. But now, of course, things have changed. And chances are that his brothers and his father's household, of course, have kept up with what's been happening to David. So as family tends to do, they gathered around him to no doubt join forces with him and to be a means of protection and companionship to him there. But we find out in verse 2 that it's not just his family that's gathering around him. There's a very interesting group of people who are attracted to David. It says everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was literally bitter of soul or discontented. All these people gathered to him, and he became captain over them. And it says there were about 400 men with him.
This is a pretty quick accumulation of guys to be with you. I mean, it's one thing if you're on the run, and you know, four or five guys are like, "We're with you, man." You can be kind of nimble and stuff. You got 400 guys. All of a sudden, you have like a little army mm-hmm. here. You got like a little squad. That you got to start thinking about food and all. Like, I mean, feeding five guys is different than feeding 400 guys, right? All of a sudden, you're like, well, okay, we actually have logistical problems to solve now.
Yeah, I mean, you get five or six guys together, they can devour a whole refrigerator's worth of food in a weekend pretty quickly. You can imagine trying to take care of all these soldiers. Yeah, they've got to have some organization pretty quickly with this number. if memory serves me right, the last time we heard about 400 men was way back in Genesis when Esau had 400 men with him. When Jacob returned from his exile, Esau comes out to meet him and he's got 400 men with him, which of course was very impressive and indicative of Esau's power and authority and influence back then. And so this is more or less saying about David, hey, he's attracting people. I mean, we can talk about the kind of people he's attracting, but nonetheless, people are coming to him. So he's got a pretty sizable force here that he's going to be able to use, as we'll see in the stories that come after this, a sizable force to use in attacking and raiding and doing whatever it takes to kind of work his way back into the realm of the throne.
And we do know that David is not just a good warrior himself, but from all accounts, he actually is a good military leader.
Yeah, yeah, he certainly knows what he's doing. He's not a novice, in other words. I mean, he's been going out and leading the armies of Israel for quite a while now. So his experience, he knows what he's doing. And I suppose one of the reasons he attracts the people that he does, people in distress, we're not told what kind of distress, but some kind of distress, and people who were in debt and everyone who was discontented or bitter of soul. Presumably, these are people who are basically kind of they have nothing else to lose, we might say, you know, they're being oppressed by the system that Saul himself has set up, whatever it might be. They're the kind of people who don't have a whole lot to lose if they have anything to lose at all. And so, you know, those people are dangerous.
Yeah.
those people will do just about anything that is necessary. So I'm sure that David has his hands full. Not only does he have kind of this logistical challenge of taking care of 400 men, but these aren't like 400 guys who are probably the most scrupulous of characters. I'm guessing that these are people who are going to need a pretty strong commander to keep them in check.
Doesn't this kind of sound like the sort of people that Jesus would gather and attract to himself?
Right. That's exactly what I was thinking when I was reading this, that, sounds a whole lot like the group of people who were attracted to the son of David
as
well.
A bunch of debtors and bitter of soul and got nothing else to live for.
Yeah. You
know, sounds like a bunch of people who's like, well, this is our last hope.
Yeah.
Like, if I don't get a regime change, it's all over for me. So,
yeah. Yeah, so David and the son of David are alike in the kind of people that are attracted to them. You know, it's kind of when I read the commentaries on this, they were described as sort of this, you know, kind of guerrilla warfare group, or the malcontents, or various other designations for people who are kind of like that. These aren't your typical citizens, in other words. So anyway, there's a bunch of them. I'm guessing that some of these guys brought, you know, their families with them, or their wives with them at least. So when it says 400 men, there's a chance it's a whole lot more than just 400 people, just 400 men, probably including at least a few women and children. So after that, it says that David had to take care of his family. So he goes to Moab, to Mizpah, someplace in Moab. And he addresses the king of Moab, and he says, please let my father and my mother come and stay with you until I know what God will do with me. By the way, I love that last phrase. Let my parents stay here because I don't have any idea what God is going to do with me. Yeah. So I was reading it this morning, and it just struck me as it's just kind of a great phrase. Like, you know, I know God is going to do something. I just don't know what.
Yeah.
So I want to make sure that my family's taken care of. So let them stay here until God makes it clear what he has in store for me.
And this, I think this is fairly obvious that the reason David is doing this is because he assumes that as he's on the run doing the things that he's going to be doing, that his family is not safe from Saul. That right. Saul is going to make his way down to Bethlehem and do who knows what to interrogate his family. So he's just trying to get ahead of that and get them somewhere else in hiding.
Yeah, and we learned in chapter 20 that the made-up story that Jonathan told his dad was that David had gone down to be with his family in Bethlehem for their monthly feast. Now, I don't know that Saul actually believed David was in Bethlehem, But it was a reminder to Saul that David had family down there.
Yep.
And so, yeah, to make sure they're safe, David does the wise thing here. Now, the reason he goes to Moab, we're not told this, but I'm assuming the reason that he goes to the king of Moab is because David's great-grandmother, Ruth, was from Moab. So probably because of these family connections, David decides that he is going to go outside the borders of Israel. He's not going to try and hide them in some Israelite city because, well, you just never know which Israelite city is going to be safe, which Israelites are going to be allied to him or to King Saul. So he decides safest bet is to take them back where his family on his great-grandmother's side came from, to the king of Moab. So he leaves them there, and they stayed with him all the time that David was in the stronghold, wherever that was. We're actually never told precisely where this stronghold's at, but I guess what happened was they left the cave for a while. They moved into this other kind of fortress, this stronghold. Then we're introduced to a new character that we'll hear more about as we go along. He's the prophet Gad. No introduction. He just kind of shows up, and it says the prophet Gad said to David, "Do not stay in the stronghold. Depart and go into the land of Judah." So David departed and went into the forest of Hereth. This is intriguing because this is the first of actually many instances that we're going to see in the next couple chapters where David has access to the will of God, what God wants him to do. But in contrast, Saul does not.
Yeah,
it seems to be an ongoing theme in these next couple chapters.
Yeah, it's also interesting that David has access to the will of God, but via means. God doesn't do a lot of like speaking to David directly. And mm-hmm. and this is something that's interesting. Is like as we've been going through the Old Testament, you know, sometimes Jacob will, you know, he'll hear from God, or Joseph will hear from God, or there's dreams or visions and this kind of stuff. Since Samuel, we're starting to see that God is sort of speaking just through people. He's maybe coming to certain people, but he's not just coming to whoever he wants to talk to anymore. And I think that you start to see that transition happen where the prophets play a more major role as sort of the mouthpiece of God in the rest of the Old Testament.
Yeah, absolutely. You see that especially with the rise of the monarchy. You know, once we have a king, most of the time, the people who speak for God, people to whom God speaks, and then the people who speak for God are the prophets.
Yep.
So, I mean, there's certainly a coincidental connection between the rise of the monarchy and the rise of the number of prophets. Those two go hand in glove. And you're right. I mean, if you read the early chapters of Genesis, not even the early chapters, almost all the way through it, it's striking how different it is how God speaks to people, right? I mean, He shows up at Abraham's tent.
Yeah, or he'd
and
show
has
up
a
to,
meal with him, you know.
Show up to, you know, Samson's parents, you know, or whatever, and tell them, give them a message. It seems that those things are waning.
Yeah, yeah, they're waning, and the prophets are waxing. They're becoming more and more the chosen means that God will use. And we have evidence later in David's reign that, you know, sometimes David will, like when he wants to build the temple, he'll come up, you know, with this idea, hey, and I'm living in a house, God's living in a tent, I think that I should build God a house. And at first the prophet's like, sure, do whatever's in your heart, that sounds good. And then God will come to the prophet and say, no, that's not what's going to happen. Go back to David and tell him, this is my plan. So sometimes the prophets are there more or less affirming the king, but then sometimes God has to correct the prophet or speak to the prophet with a correcting word,
so
saying, no, this is my plan.
Prophet is a rough vocation because someone might ask you something and you might think you know the answer, right? And you just say it,
yeah.
And then God comes back to you, what are you doing? Like, that's not,
yeah.
You didn't ask me
that's
about
not
this.
What I want.
That's not,
right.
You're like, oh, I just assumed you didn't care about this one. My bad.
Yeah. And you also have, at the same time, this rise of prophecy, you have the rise of false prophecy, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because you've got, you know, how many kings have these false prophets gathered around them? Either false prophets who claim to speak for Yahweh or false prophets who are prophets of false gods, like the prophets of Baal. Either way, the kings seem to surround themselves with kind of yes-sir men. those who are more or less just going to tell them what they want to hear. And so the true prophets, they get a bad name because they're called the troublers of Israel, because they don't tell the king what he wants to hear. Well, this prophet Gad tells David that God wants him to move on, so he does. Now, we switch from a narrative about David to a narrative about Saul, and this is going to take up most of the rest of the chapter. The Old Testament has lots of low points, lots of real dark stories, but this ranks, in my opinion, this ranks as one of the top 10 of these dark stories in the Old Testament, just because of the sheer heartlessness of it, the brutality of it, and the fact that this comes from the Lord's anointed. So what we're going to encounter here with the verse 6 and following is the massacre of a whole town full of priests. So Saul, verse 6, Saul hears that David and his men and who were with him had been discovered. And Saul was sitting in Gibeah, his hometown, under the tamarisk tree on the height. And he's got a spear in his hand. And all his servants were standing around him. I know I pointed this out a couple times already, but always notice that when Saul is there, it's like he has a spear in his hand. David never has a spear in his hand, but Goliath had a spear in his hand. So this is a wink, that Saul is more or less becoming like a foreign king. He's becoming like a foreign power. You think of Goliath and his spear, now you have Saul and his spear. And of course, it's with his spear that he's tried to kill not only David multiple times, but even his son, Jonathan, as well.
I think it tells you how that Saul is paranoid, too. Saul feels like he must be armed at all times.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, just imagine a guy who's like walking around town. He's always got a pistol in his hand.
Yeah, he is always thinking that just today, any second could be the second that someone tries to take me out.
Yeah, yeah. And his paranoia is evident in his speech as well. He verse 7 and 8, even though in our English translations, 7 and 8 are usually broken up into two or three sentences. In Hebrew, it's like one long running sentence. It's as if Saul just can't stop talking, just goes on and on and on in this long speech. So listen to it and just kind of get into the head of Saul when he speaks to his fellow tribesmen. He says, "Hear now, O Benjaminites, will the son of Jesse also give to all of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? For all of you have conspired against me, so that there is no one who discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. And there's none of you who is sorry for me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in ambush as it is this day." So Saul is, well, first of all, intentional or not, Saul has just expressed that he has fulfilled all of the predictions that Samuel gave about what the king would do when the king came along. When the people asked for a king, Samuel's like, "If you want a king, let me tell you what the king is going to do. He's going to take your vineyards. He's going to take your fields. He's going to take your young men. He's going to take your young women. He's going to tax you. He's going to do all of, he's going to take, take, take." And Saul begins his speech by saying, "Hey, I took fields and vineyards and gave them to you. I made you commanders of thousands and of hundreds." So Saul is more or less living up to the threat that Samuel had voiced back in chapter 8 about what a king would do.
Yeah, it does seem too. I mean, this paranoia is like, yeah, running deep because, okay, it's true enough that somehow David has accumulated to himself 400 guys, which is not nothing. So maybe this is partially what he's talking about. Like, hey, there seems to be some guys missing, what's that about? But so while that might be true, Saul does seem to assume that there's like this massive coup and everybody's in on it.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Like everybody's conspiring against him, which of course is not true.
Yeah. Which is not true. Yeah. I mean, first of all, these are his fellow tribesmen. These aren't like people from the tribe of, you know, Asher or the tribe of Judah. These are his family, more or less, his extended family. And he thinks that all of them know everything, and they're withholding all of this from him, and they're conspiring together against him.
Yeah, this makes more sense. Them, This would make more sense if he went down to Bethlehem and said, all right, Bethlehem, I know that this dude like came down here. Where's his family? Seems that there's about 400 guys missing. Like, why are, you know, like, yeah. This town really shrunk rapidly. That would make a little more sense, but he's not, that's not what he's doing at all.
No. And he's accusing them of things which are patently not true, right? I mean, yeah, the son of Jesse did make a covenant with Jonathan, but the covenant was not that he was going to, you know, lie in ambush and kill Saul, just the opposite. So, yeah, that he's paranoid. He either believes falsely or he's been given false information. We're not, you know, not exactly sure. Notice, too, that he still can't bring himself to call David David. He still just refers to him as a son of Jesse. He won't even use his name anymore. And after he gives his rant, none of his tribesmen speaks up, which I find interesting. Of course, this is speculation, but my speculation is that they all realize that Saul has lost it. You know, they've seen how he's been behaving. Of course, they know all of his stories that we've been covering. So they're probably all thinking to themselves, something's got to change.
Well,
because Saul just gets crazier and crazier all the time.
Here's your practical advice. The application of this text is that if a madman is ranting with a spear in his hand, you know, you don't want to be the first one to say, I don't know if all that's true. Like, I don't think anyone wants to be that guy.
No. Yeah.
So you either have to affirm everything this guy is saying, or you got to keep your mouth shut.
Yeah. Silence is wisdom in this regard. So we're now in verse 9. We are reintroduced to a guy that we encountered in the last chapter. You may remember if you listened to the last episode that just seeming out of nowhere when we were having this back and forth between David and the priest at the city of Nob, that verse 7 of chapter 21 threw in this guy. It says there was one of the servants of Saul there that day, and his name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief of Saul's shepherds. And then that's it. It's kind of thrown in there, and then the narrative moves on from there. Well, now we are told why there was that foreshadowing or that introduction of this character back in the previous chapter. Because verse 9 of chapter 22 says, after Saul delivered his rant, that Doeg, this guy, the Edomite, so this is a foreigner who was employed by Saul as the chief of his shepherds, that Doeg was standing by the servants of Saul, and he spoke up. He says, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahituv. And, he adds, and he inquired of the Lord for him, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Now, first of all, yes, the second and third part of that is true, that he did give him provisions, and he did give him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. But there's no reference whatsoever in chapter 21 that the priest inquired of the Lord for him. We're told there was a conversation. You know, at first the priest was a little bit nervous because David just shows up out of nowhere and he's needing provisions. He's needing a sword. We talked about all that. But there was, David didn't say to the priest, hey, I need you to bring out the Urim and Thummim and inquire of God for me and find out what his will is for my future actions. There's no reference whatsoever made to that. But Doeg brings that up. And I think the reason he brings it up is this is his way of kind of, you know, not flattering the king, but trying to get on the king's good side. He's like, oh yeah, yeah. I not only did he give him bread and the sword, but he actually inquired of God for him, with kind of implicit in that, you know, you don't have any access to God right now, but the priest more or less, you know, committed this crime against you by inquiring of God for your enemy. Well, verse 11 says the king wanted to deal with the situation. So he sent someone to summon Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahituv. Not just him, but all his father's household, the priests who were at Nob, and all of them came to the king. You can just imagine what was going through their minds when a runner shows up and says, hey, the king wants to see you. That's never, never good. Verse 12, Saul says, "Listen now, son of Ahituv." You notice this is another insult. He doesn't address him by his first name. He refers to him the same way he refers to David. He calls David the son of Jesse. He calls the priest not by his first name, Ahimelech, but he calls him son of Ahituv. Now, the priest presumably does not know what's going on. He's like, "Here I am, my lord." Then Saul says to him, "Why have you and the son of Jesse conspired against me?" This is more of his, thinking everybody's against him. "Why have you and the son of Jesse conspired against me, in that you have..." Now, notice the change of order here in these three things. So Doeg said he inquired of God, gave him provisions and the sword. When Saul reports this to the priest, he says, "Why have you given him bread and a sword and have inquired of God for him?" So he reverses the order. If it's ABC when Doeg speaks, then it's BCA when Saul repeats this. And I think the reason he's done this is because he's more or less saved the most treasonous act for the third in that list. So for Saul, it's not, the worst was not that the priest gave him bread or a sword, but they inquired of God for him. Because Saul, as we've pointed out, has no access to God at this point. God is not answering him. And then he finishes up by saying that he should rise up against me by lying in ambush as it is this day.
Another thing to which there is no evidence of.
Right. Yeah, it's all just made up. Whether Saul actually believes this, he's exaggerating, I don't know, but I think he actually has convinced himself that this is true. He thinks that David, and in fact his son, and now the priest, that everybody's against him. The whole world's against poor King Saul. Well, Ahimelech, he has no idea all this is going on. So he says, "Who among all your servants..." It's like no worse thing he could have said. He's like, "Who among all your servants is as faithful as David, even the king's son-in-law, who is captain over your guard and is honored in your house?" So I'm thinking, poor Ahimelech has no clue. I mean, he's probably trying to figure this out even as he's speaking. So he does the worst possible thing, at least in his situation. He praises David that is now the chief enemy of Saul.
And here we see the first instance of someone getting triggered.
Yeah, this is definitely a triggering moment for Saul. Oh, yeah, it's a... And then he goes on. He says, now it's... Verse 15 is a little bit tricky to translate because... Well, let me read the New American Standard. It said, "Did I just begin to inquire of God for him today? Far be it from me." Now, that could be taken a couple different ways, and you can translate the Hebrew a couple different ways. It can mean either that the priest is saying, "Listen, you know, I've been inquiring of God on David's behalf for a long time, so today wasn't the first day." Or it could be translated so as to mean, "Did I begin to inquire for David of God today? No, I've never inquired of God for David." So it can be taken a couple different ways. My opinion is it probably means that Ahimelech is saying, "Listen, I don't really know what you're talking about. I didn't inquire for him the other day, and I never inquired of God for him before, so I don't really know what your accusation is based on." And then he finishes out saying, "Don't let the king impute anything to his servant or to any of the household of my father, because I really don't know anything about what's going on." Literally, I don't know anything about this matter, small or great. In other words, all of this is news to me. Hey, all I know is David showed up. He said he was from you. I gave him bread. I gave him a sword. You know, he's your son-in-law. He's the commander of your armies. So why wouldn't I? Why wouldn't I do that? So poor Ahimelech is just caught not knowing what in the world is going on, not understanding the basis of the accusations, and acting on the assumption that you know, David is someone to be honored and someone to be provided for if he's in need. Verse 16 is where things go downhill very rapidly. It says that the king said, "You shall surely die, Ahimelech." you, not just you, but you and all your father's household. The king then turned to the guards, literally the runners who were attending him, said, turn around and put the priest of the Lord to death, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew that he was fleeing and did not reveal it to me. Now, the king says this, but it ends up saying that the servants of the king were not willing to put forth their hands to attack the priest of the Lord. So, yeah, good for the guards. They were not going to commit not only murder, but sacrilege by murdering the priest.
I mean, this is a command that any reasonable person
would refuse.
Well, I mean, it's going to feel very conflicted about. I mean, that you're saying, I don't think that we can do that.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, and props to them, because you are dealing with like a madman at this point. And so to refuse is obviously a dangerous thing too. But obviously even the people close to Saul, working for Saul, are like, okay, man, that's too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's time for, at this time, it's time for either passive or active rebellion against the king, one of the two. So they don't do what he says. And, you know, that's good of them for recognizing just the craziness of the command and refusing to do it. However, the king turns to Doeg, the Edomite, and says, well, then you turn around and attack the priest. Well, Doeg had no scruples about doing this whatsoever. In fact, he didn't seem to have any scruples whatsoever about doing anything, since he turned and he attacked the priest. And he killed that day 85 men who wore the linen ephod. It'd be kind of like, so they're described by means of their more or less a uniform. It'd be like us, you know, if there were 85 priests who were martyred, for us to say that 85 men who wore the clerical were massacred that day. So these were 85 priests who were killed, that the whole household of the priest Ahimelech. And not only that, but verse 19, he says that he struck the city of Nob, the city of the priest, with the edge of the sword, and just didn't kill the men, but he killed the men, the women, the children, the infants, and even the animals, the oxen, the donkeys, the sheep, he struck with the edge of the sword. So this is more or less the act of Cherem that we've talked about back in Joshua, where every living thing is put to death in the city of Nob. This is, as I said earlier, this is in my opinion, one of the darkest and lowest points in Israel's history, because you have a king of Israel who has lost his mind and commands the murder of innocent people. And when his own guards refuse to do it, he enlists the hands of a foreign servant to engage in this murderous act of sacrilege. So this is, if you go to Psalm 52, this is another one of those events that David memorializes in one of his Psalms. And it's very easy to see in Psalm 52 that this is a pretty accurate conjunction of narrative and poetry, because when you read through Psalm 52, you can definitely see that he's talking about Doeg, the Edomite, as well as Saul, and how their tongues are like swords and end up devouring people. So we're not gonna be able to finish the chapter. That just leaves us with a few verses left, but it's an introduction to what we're gonna see as a long drawn out exile of David, struggle of David against Saul, and the ongoing demise, we might say, of Saul, and the ongoing upraising of David. But for now, he's going to have to endure several more years of exile before he is brought to the throne.
Yeah, and I don't know. You can tell me if you think this is a stretch at all, Chad. But whenever I read this, because of who David is, it seems to me that you sort of have at least a version of like first martyrs. You know, in the life of Jesus, you know, a lot of people will call the death of the innocents, you know, when Herod has mm-hmm. all the infants killed, they're trying to seek out Jesus, and those are oftentimes referred to as the first martyrs. I think that there you can go back even further and say when David, of course, you know, Jesus is the son of David, when David was being pursued by the king who was trying to exterminate him. There's martyrs that happened as well. I sort of read these as sort of the first sort of Old Testament martyrs, or sort of a foreshadowing of what will become a sort of ordinary thing in martyrdom.
Yeah, I fully agree with you. I mean, martyr is someone who's basically giving witness to the faith, giving witness to the true God. And here it certainly applies. And it is. I mean, it's a martyrdom. It's as well as a foreshadowing of those Christian martyrs who will come by great numbers, especially the first couple of centuries of the church's history.
Well, that's not the greatest note to leave the podcast on. But hey, as of right now, David, whom Christ will come, he is safe and on the run. So that's a good thing, because we're gonna need the Son of David to come along. All right, Chad, I will see you next week.
All right, see you here.